Hi everybody, my name is Stevie B and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, member of the Westside Men's Group and the Golden Text Group in Dania. So good to be here with you guys tonight. And yes, I'm going to be hitting the big 5-0 this week, this Thursday. And it's very exciting. Came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 22 years old, just turned 22. So the idea that I'm going to be celebrating in Alcoholics Anonymous my 50th birthday is very exciting because I never thought that I would stay that long. As a matter of fact, I didn't come to stay. I came to, as I said last week, I just came to get clean. And clean did not mean clean off alcohol. Clean just meant clean off drugs. And so I didn't come to stay. I came to go through a spin dry, get all spinned up, sent back to college, finish my senior year, go back to life. And little did I know this would become a way of life. I'm very grateful for that, of course. I wasn't always grateful for that. I used to feel like, well, you know, why couldn't I drink? I look at people that would be able to drink, the big book says, with impunity and hate people that can do that. I also hate people, you know, just a little side note, I also hate people that when I go out to dinner and they don't finish their dessert. So I don't like anyone that doesn't finish the stuff that they order. I definitely get resentful. So what we're going to do is this. Last week we talked about that we admitted we are powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become a mantra. That's step one. And this week we're going to talk about came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step two. And what I'm going to do just for this week also is just continue the story. I'm going to continue the story show you exactly how God worked in my life even before I knew his first name, which is God. So where we were last week for a continuation is I was at Emeril Lagasse's restaurant. We got one of the chefs, there's a chef here tonight that studied them at Emeril Lagasse, so I figured I'd throw this story in for him. And I'm in Emeril Lagasse's new restaurant, and I'm sitting there with my new wife. Well, my wife. It's not like I have a new wife and an old wife. I had a wife. And I'm sitting there. We just got married. We're on our honeymoon, right? And I'm 5.5 years sober. I'm 30 years old at the time. And alcoholism has returned back into my life. The insanity returned back in my life. You see, I'm a firm believer that if we're not doing work every single day to battle our alcoholism, that it will return before we pick up the drink. Now, I didn't know that. I thought alcoholism can only return after we pick up the drink. That's not the truth. In my case, alcoholism returned way before I picked up the drink. As a matter of fact, I needed to have a drink when alcoholism returned. I was restless. I was irritable. I was on edge. I was always talking fast. You know, always next thing. You know, I could never sit and have a conversation because I'm always thinking about so alcoholism had returned. My wife didn't know that, though. My new wife, my only wife. And we had just had our wedding, and we went on. She's from the country of Colombia, so she didn't know anything about the United States. She didn't know anything about cities. And she said, where would you like to go? And my parents said, where would you like to go? And I had alcoholism returned. I didn't know that. And I said I wanted to go to New Orleans for our honeymoon. So we went to New Orleans. I made a reservation at NOLA's. And it was a brand new restaurant, you know, very hard to get in. And we're sitting there in the restaurant. And my wife just knows me as sober. You know, she knows me as a good guy, spiritual guy, sober guy. You know, the whole 2.5, 3 years or 4 years that we were dating, obviously I didn't drink, so I was sober. And then I was a pretty good guy. You know, the guy that she saw, the one face that she saw was a good guy. She didn't see all the different personalities that I had going on behind the scenes. You know, the committee that's going on, that's speaking right now. As I'm speaking, you have a committee speaking, and you're either listening to me or you're listening to the committee right now. And so she didn't know that I had a committee going on as we were talking all the time. She didn't realize how many people were actually in our relationship. who had a multifaceted relationship. She thought she was just marrying me and we were going to have a great one-on-one relationship, and that's not true. I was having a relationship with her, I was having a relationship with me, and all my voices in my head. So we're sitting there, all of us at dinner, and she's you know, she's really into me. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, she got a good catch. You know, my wife really made out well. And, well, I mean, you're supposed to be into the person you're marrying, of course. And, but alcoholism is all over me, and I don't know it. You know, so I'm sure people told me, I'm sure my sponsor told me, Myron told me that I wasn't going in the right direction. But when you're 30 years old, you're already 6 years sober, you already have two cars, you already have a house, you already have two businesses, you're going to the gym every day, nobody can tell you anything. You know, because you really, you don't feel like you're at the bottom of anything. I feel like I was on top of the world. You know, so what are you going to tell me? You know, I had all the answers. And once we have all the answers, that's the beginning of the end. Because then ego has returned. And for me, ego is edging God out. Edging God out. So I was edging God out. God was definitely second or third. In the beginning, I would pray on my knees in the morning and ask Him for the gift of sobriety. By then, I was probably doing a brushing the teeth prayer. Thank you, God, for the sobriety. And probably praying once in a while on my knees. And, you know, it wasn't... I didn't really think God was a priority. I thought God was almost like an asterisk. It was like He was good. You know, it's good. It's good. It's good to believe in God. If you would ask me back then, were you a believer in God? I would say, yeah, of course I'm. I'm Catholic and Jewish. So I'm both. Of course I believe in God. But I didn't really like make a commitment for God, and that showed up. So we're in the restaurant and they serve alcohol in the table next to us, because in those fancy restaurants there's tables right on top of each other. I told you the story last week. They served this fine wine in the table next to me, and they did a whole fine wine presentation, and at that moment I decided that I wanted to drink fine wine. I had never had fine wine. Then in my mind I thought to myself, it's probably the reason that I had to go to treatment is because I missed fine wine. You know, because I never saw fine wine up until that very moment when they served fine wine in a decanter in the middle of the table, and the service said that they would, this wine was so fine that they had to let it breathe first. Once they said that they were drinking fine wine that needs to breathe first, something kicked up inside me and said, I gotta have that type of wine. I've never even seen wine that needs to breathe first, or ever heard of it, to be honest with you. So I knew right then. That's what I was going to do. I was going to drink fine wine and maybe other things, because I was into cigars back then. I was big into cigars, so I was reading these magazines, Cigar Aficionado, and in the magazines they always had a guy with a cigar, and always walking in the room was a beautiful, like you, like in a tall, blonde drink of water with a long red dress, and everyone was sophisticated, and I just wanted to be sophisticated, and I figured, you know, probably you drink this, you're probably going to be sophisticated. I can see already I'm going to be intelligent if I drink this fine wine. So I put it in my mind I was going to be a sophisticated fine wine, Cavassier type of... No, not an alcoholic. Like a connoisseur of types, you know. And so from my fifth year of sobriety when I got married to my seventh year when I picked up, I did not believe I was powerless over alcohol anymore. I knew that I was powerless over other things other than alcohol, but I did not believe that I was powerless over alcohol. And I put that in my mind. And once you put that in your mind, if you continue with that vein of thought that you could do something, well, it's either work for you good or work for you bad. I mean, if you continue to think you could be the president of a company, well, you could probably be the president of the company. If you continue to think you can drink successfully, well, you're going to drink. Whether you're going to be successful or not depends if you have alcoholism. So for 2 years, I didn't fixate on it, but I thought of it. You know, I'd see someone drinking in a restaurant, I would say, well, that's nice. And finally, I did. So when I took that drink, and that drink went down, and immediately I thought, I like this. You know, immediately. Now, first of all, I never got to fine wine in the whole experimentation, that year and a half that I was out there. One time I drank some wine, it wasn't fine. But the first night out of sobriety, and I went to look for fine wine, but I went to a Chinese restaurant, and They only had Japanese rice wine in a box. And so I ordered that, you know, definitely not Nola's quality, and drank that wine. But it didn't really have what I was looking for. And I knew I had some other stuff in the house. Even though I was sober 6.5 years, I still would keep pills around, like if I would go to an accident, you know, for emergencies. Like someday, if I'm ever, if I've ever had an arm come off, or, you know, there's no paramedics around, you know, I'm probably going to need this type of medication. So alcoholism was already in my house by me keeping pills in the house, you know, for years. You know, my wife said, "Do you really need these?" I'm like, "You don't know what's going to happen. Who knows what's going to happen? I could fall down the stairs and paramedics could be..." I'm not sure what happened. Keep talking? Just keep talking? Oh, okay. It's working? Okay, there we go. Back on. Okay, back on. So I took that drink, and then I knew I had pills in the house. And so I took some pills with the drink. And by the way, it's much better combination, it turned out, than just the fine wine alone. So my first... Whoa. Thank you, Annie. Oh, very nice. My first night... I think it's going to go in and out. No, maybe just push it in. What do you think? There we go. Okay, I want to stay. I'm just going to talk a little. It's going to go in and out. Okay. Well, my first night, I passed out. I took the drink, then I took a pills. Should I just talk without the microphone, maybe? Yeah. All right.
Let me just help you out.
No, it's not there. It's down there. It's at the source. You see, the thing about this is you need to be plugged into the source. If you try to get plugged in over here without the source, it's still not going to work. You see how we immediately went to the place over here? That's what sometimes we do. We go to the place that's not the source. It seems like the easier, softer way, like we go to the gym. We figure, let me go to the gym. Let me work on the outside. It's probably going to do the same results. But after we go to the gym for a while, and the body fat comes off, and you're looking good, and you realize that doesn't work. That's not the source. So then you go buy something. You go buy something to impress people that you don't know, with stuff you can't afford. You're like, this is going to work out just fine. Let me just buy this. This should work out real nice. Get like Prada glasses or something. And you go buy stuff that you can't afford, and then that doesn't work. This is gonna be an experience here. This is gonna be an experience. You think at a temple, you know, God would have already figured this out before we got here. But he's gonna use this as part of the experience. Anyway, my first night back to drinking was already... You tell me what to do. I think we just stay away from the microphone. Can you guys hear me back there? So that's what we're going to have to do. That's all. So my first night back to drinking was already passed out. And here my wife, we're just brandly new married, and here she has her husband passed out in the house, but not a passed out like slumped passed out. I passed out and slammed my head on the floor, passed, you know, like face forward passed out, because I hadn't had any drugs and alcohol in my system for 7 years. And put those two things together, you don't just slump, you fall. So according to her and her best friend, both from the country of Colombia, they were going to call 911. Her friend said that they should throw water at me, and they did. They threw water at me, threw it in my face. I came to. You know, I said, honey, there must have been a reaction with the cold medicine that I took earlier in the day. But you knew I was going to try drinking. I tried drinking. Obviously, this is not working out. So I'm not going to drink anymore, you know, during the week. And my wife said, that's fine. My wife said, as long as you don't drink during the week, because she didn't know anything about alcoholism. And neither did my parents. And neither did the people that I was talking to, because I, like I said, and I'm not going to get into drugs tonight, but I want to say, I didn't come in to, with sobriety for drinking. I came in for one substance and stayed, and I was off that substance. My family just figured, well, listen, as long as you don't go back to the way you were in college when you were snorting up all that stuff, you should be fine. You know, we don't think you should drink, but it's two different camps, really. It's one's drinking and one's drugs. You know, so as long as you don't go back to that stuff, you should be fine. And I felt the same way. I had no intentions, even though I did it the first night. But I'm saying, other than that, I had no intentions of going back to any type of hard drugs. That would be ridiculous. But here's the most amazing thing about alcoholism. Matter of fact, is Rachel James here tonight? No. They just lost a very dear friend. I don't know if you guys heard. Yeah. There's a guy that we just lost in the community. And I don't want to say his name because you guys are going to know him. And if you don't know, then you're going to... And everyone's going to freak out. And he was just an alcoholic a couple months ago. And I don't mean just an alcoholic. I mean, he's an alcoholic. He only drank. That's what I mean. And this week he died. And he's a member of the community up here. And very, very, very close friend of Rachel's. And she called me and she said she was all broken up last night. Very, very much broken up. And she said, you know, Mike died. And I said, I'm sorry. And so he drank. But what happens when you drink is stuff that you're not in control of when you drink. It's not like you just take a drink with a sober mind and you stay sober and then you and someone says to you, would you like to try this, and you have a sober mind. Or would you like to sleep with me, and you know you're never going to sleep with that person. And sober, you would never sleep with that person. But drunk, you're like, who the heck are you? You know, like that type of thing. And so this person that only drinks, well, this night, this week, he didn't just only drink. This week, he didn't just only drink. And so this week, he died. From just not only drinking. You see, when we go and we step back into that world, it's really anything goes. So I know, I understand we have a singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I agree, but really my singleness of purpose is to save lives. And what that means is this. Anything I put into my body at any time has the potential to have me go back for more. And anything that I do that has to do with sin, I'm going to like. And so my really, what I mean by sin, anything that has to do with an excess. Like I go on, like next week I'm going to go on a sober cruise, which is with beautiful snow, and it's going to be great. And there's a whole bunch of people that go on that cruise that are in AA that they use the casino on the ship. And that's fine, because we're not in GA. But I do not. Let me tell you why. I know I like it. I don't touch it, but I know I like it. And I know if I go in there and I start gambling and all of a sudden I win, it's going to hit off something inside me. And I'm going to say, I'd like to go back. So what happened to me when I took that drink, and I just had 7 years, that drink said to me, we need to keep this party going on. And my wife said to me, you can't drink here during the week. You can only drink here on Saturday nights. Well, then I had to figure out a way to do stuff behind the scenes that would not allow my wife to know that I was using any type of substances. And I had to figure out other ways and means to continue the party going on. And a funny story is, and this is really the truth, is I did find other stuff that was not as noticeable as drinking. It was less noticeable to her, definitely more noticeable to me. And what I would do is, we have this little garage. And behind the, and it's like there's a wall, and behind the wall I have a workbench. And if anybody knows me, you know, it's really a workbench in name only. It's got tools. It definitely has tools, and it's definitely a workbench. But if anybody knows me, there's not much work that I know how to do with tools. So, but I had them just in case, because I figured if I was a homeowner, I should have a whole tools. I bought a top line tools, had them all hanging on the wall, you know, best tools and all that stuff. All my tools still probably have the price tags on them. So after I relapsed, after I went back to the world of addiction, I would go behind that wall and I would just take the hammer and I'd just make stuff, you know, but not really. I like get wood, you know, put some nails in the end and bang stuff. And my wife said, "Sweetheart, are you coming to bed? It's like 2:30 in the morning." I say, "Sweetheart, I'm building shelves over here for our house. You know, I'm trying to make this house beautiful. I'm not trying to pay somebody to come here and make shelves. I'm going to make our own shelves." And every night after I found other stuff to keep me going that she wouldn't notice, I'd be up all night making fake shelves. Never had a shelf come out. Same three pieces of pine wood. Same. When I finally got sober, my wife went back there and she saw that nothing was made. So 9/11 happens. My wife flees this country, and this is the truth. She goes to the country of Colombia, where she's from. She can't take it anymore. She doesn't know that I'm doing other stuff other than alcohol. She thinks I'm having a nervous breakdown. And she didn't leave because I was having a nervous breakdown. She left because it was just so unmanageable in the house that she had to go get family support. And she flew down to her family, and she said, "My husband has lost it." Really, you know what's going on behind the scenes. I'm not sleeping all night long. I'm making shelves 24 hours a day. I'm losing weight. I mean, I'm just looking bug-eyed, you know. I go to a psychiatrist, right? She goes with me to the psychiatrist. And we tell the psychiatrist everything. You know, we're having marital problems. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I keep thinking the police are coming at all the hours of the night. One time I called the police on myself. I'm telling this to a psychiatrist. My wife tells the psychiatrist, "I think he's lost his mind. This is terrible. He has had a nervous breakdown." And the psychiatrist agreed. The psychiatrist agreed that I was having a nervous breakdown. And I agreed that I was having a nervous breakdown. Now, I know that I'm taking stuff other than alcohol, and I'm using it all the time. I don't tell the psychiatrist that. Because I actually think that this is what's helping me. I actually think that this is what's saving me. That if I didn't have this, that I would actually fall apart. See, that's the most amazing thing about alcoholism. The thing that's actually killing us, we think that is the thing that's actually saving us. That's what they call denial. And I was in total denial. My poor wife had to leave the country, and she just, for her own sanity, because the disease of alcoholism will invade your family. And she was getting very, very sick, the poor thing. And she wasn't eating. And she went from 110 pounds to 90 pounds. And she was looking all frail. And it almost killed her. She's never done a drink or a drug in her entire life. And alcoholism almost killed my wife. So she left just for her own safety. 9/11 happens. And I'm sure we're going to figure this out by the time Peter comes next week. I hope so. And I'm sitting in front of the TV, and 9/11 is happening. And I'm so divorced from reality. I'm so drunk. I'm so out of my mind. My sister calls and she says, "We just lost our friend, her best friend, my friend, her best friend in the Twin Towers." And I say to her, this is what I say to her. Thinking that it's a movie, I say to her, "What does that matter to me? I'm in Florida. You know, don't bother me. I think it's a movie. I'm watching the collapse of the Twin Towers. I'm from New York. Our friend is dead. And I think I'm watching a movie. I'm divorced from all reality." Once that happened, my sister knew, my parents knew, and they got in a car, left my sister there to mourn. They got in a car and they drove down because you couldn't get any planes at the time. And they came down to Florida to save my life. They managed to get open. I had broken the keys off in the door to make sure that nobody could just come in the door. They managed to get through the door and they found me there in an alcoholic mess. Much shock to my family since I was just 6.5 years sober. I just got married. I just had a big sober wedding. And now I'm laying there in alcoholism. Now, but my wife is away. My parents come up with a great plan. They think that if they can get me sober me up, clean the house, you know, put away all the nonsense from the house, get her, throw them in garbage bags, clean everything up, and get me sober by the time my wife comes, that maybe they can save our marriage. And so they start on the process of trying to save my life and trying to save my marriage. But the thing about it is that the alcoholic, which was me, didn't want to save my life and save my marriage. So your parents, my parents could do it as much, they can just continue to try to save me. But until I was ready to save me, I couldn't be saved. So they did a bunch of interventions and took me to meetings, and I would leave the meetings and I would get high up after the meetings and during the meetings. My parents didn't live with me at the time, so they would drop me back over the house. They'd take the car keys. They'd lock me in the house. But you can't keep an alcoholic tied up if an alcoholic doesn't want to get sober. And so I didn't want to get sober. My wife eventually comes back. She's so worried about me because it's 9/11 time. The country's in disarray, as we know. And she flies back to try to help me with my mental breakdown. And my parents don't tell her what's going on. And she arrives at the airport on her birthday But she arrives a couple weeks after her birthday at the airport, the Miami airport from Colombia. It's just a couple weeks after her birthday. And she calls me on the landline. She calls the house and she says, I'm home. No, she says, I'm in the airport. Sweetheart, I can't wait to see you. Come pick me up. And I say to her, I'll be right there. But I'm stuck on stupid in the house. You know, I can't stop doing what I'm doing. So I say, I'll be right there. And she calls me back however long later, 45 minutes later. Sweetheart, I'm at the Miami airport. You know, you coming? What's going on? Now, it's landline time, so it's not like she's calling my cell phone. She's calling landline, so she knows I'm home. I said, I'll be right there. She calls back an hour later. I don't pick up the phone. So now my wife is at the airport. She thinks I'm coming. I don't pick up the phone, so she thinks I'm on my way. And I'm in that horrible, incomprehensible place of disgusted with myself and not being able to stop what I'm doing. I had turned into a bum. I left my wife there at the airport with no support. Probably she didn't have any money on her. I just take off. Because that's what we do when we're drinking. I just take off. My 74-year-old father had to go down and pick her up. And I arrived later on, of course, like a good alcoholic. I got balloons. I'm looking like I just got shot out of the back end of a cannon. I got birthday balloons. I'm like, happy birthday! Black teeth. Haven't eaten in a week. Not brushed my teeth, I'm sure. Stinking. Haven't changed my clothes. Not like you're in the middle of a run, say, let me do some laundry. Especially when your wife is not home for 3 weeks. It's not like you have fresh stuff going on. I'm like, happy birthday. And she just looked at me, tears in her eyes. My parents looked at me, tears in their eyes. And they knew. And she knew that this was not a mental breakdown. So this starts my journey into treatment centers and detoxes and trying to get Stevie cleaned up. See, Stevie just had 7 years. But Stevie now can't get 7 minutes. And all I wanted to do was have a glass of fine wine. That's all I wanted to do. I had no intention of leaving my wife at the airport. I had no intention of destroying my family, destroying my parents, pulling them out of retirement. My mom was 64. My dad was 74. They came out of retirement to try to save my life. They left my sister up there to handle funeral arrangements for a friend that just got killed in the Twin Towers. Came down there to save their 32-year-old son who is now dying. I wanted to have one glass of wine. Fine wine. I wanted to share fine wine experience that I saw other people being able to do with impunity. I looked over at them. They seemed to be having such a great time. They barely touched it. They were smelling and talking about it. And I wanted to smell and talk about wine. I wanted to be a regular person that could just take fine wine. And I became, once again, an animal. I couldn't stop drinking. Oh, by the way, I'm going to tell you what God did for me, which is an amazing thing. I never really had a problem with alcohol, and that's the truth. Once I went back to drinking, I learned I loved alcohol. So now I'm an alcoholic. And now I'm a drug addict. So I'm duly addicted. I'm also having a mental breakdown because now I got to come off all these substances. My whole life has fallen apart, and they put me into a treatment center in Miami. But I don't have insurance. But I've been sober 6.5, 7 years, so I had saved some money, you know. That's amazing how fast money goes when you have addiction hole in the bucket. So we paid $35,000 for a treatment center in Miami. But I don't really want to be there. It's my family's idea. I haven't really hit bottom. I certainly didn't do a third step. I didn't do a third step prayer. I didn't want to believe that God, or came to believe a power greater than myself, could restore me to sanity, because I didn't really care about restoring myself to sanity. I didn't really care about my life. Plus, I couldn't see my life ever amounting to anything, so who really cares? You know, because you're never going to get sober, so what's the point? And so I was telling myself all these messages, and my life's going down and down and down and down. And I wind up one night leaving and going driving and looking for things other than alcohol. And I have a 6-felony car crash. I've been in trouble with the police, but not like this type of trouble. You know, I'd spent one night in jail and another night in jail because I passed out in a parking lot once, and I gave the police officer an attitude and he punched me and I went to jail. You know, not really big things. But this is kind of a big thing. This was like, you know, driving under the influence with paraphernalia in the car and reckless endangerment and leaving the scene and other things. 6 felonies, 1 car crash. Bam. It's like, I'm like, no record, 6-felony record. Like right out of the, bam. And I'm sitting in the Miami jail, like a nice Jewish Italian kid like me, sitting in the Miami jail. I figured, this is like a case of mistaken identity. I mean, I'm with all these hoodlums and derelicts, and these people, I'm looking at these people like, these people deserve to be here. I mean, this is mistaken identity for myself. You know, what time is lunch served? And it was just a horrible experience, and you know, I'm starving. I'm always thinking about food, even on a run. You know, once I get a little bit of, I'm still like, what? You know, then lunch is served. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, bologna sandwich. I'm like, this is a horrible way to live. I start calling my family and begging them to get me out. They get me out, and I just tell them this has been a horrible mistake. You know, a horrible mistake. I took some of my medication that they prescribed me at the treatment center, and I didn't know I was supposed to drive on it. And here I am in this hot water, and you know, they kind of bought it. They bought a little bit of the story. They bought a little bit of it, but now I have no license. I have no car. No, like one of these stories. My wife says, you know, I'm done. I'm done. You gotta go. Enough is enough. You gotta go. They give me an ultimatum. You listen. You either get sober, or you gotta go. So I get sober. You know, allegedly, I get sober, which means I'm using what people not knowing I'm using. And it's Christmas. It's Christmas 2001. And my sister's going around the table and she's saying in her Christmas message how grateful she is I'm sober. But I know I'm not sober. She's counting the days because they didn't count my 6-felony car crash as part of my relapse. Because it was medication that I was taking that I was prescribed. So we were still counting my previous stay in the treatment center. So they were saying that I had like 35 days. So my sister's like, well, you know, we're so grateful that Steve has 35 days. Meanwhile, I know I got 35 seconds. You know, so already low self-esteem, feeling of inferiority, feeling like I'm a piece of garbage, I'm worthless. It's Christmas. I want to get high. You know, let's unwrap the presents, something, and how can I go on a run? You know, they're having conversations with me. I'm having conversations with myself. Now, I used to have a whole committee. Now I got a whole committee that's on crack. And they're not even making any sense. You know, they're like, Pastor, would you like to pass the turkey? And I'm thinking, how can I run out the front door? You know, it was a nightmare. And I managed to hold it together through the holidays. Until January 2nd. Now, this is what I want to tell you about. This is because then we're going to get to the second step. I managed to hold it together until January 2nd. But January 2nd, I got to reward myself for getting through the holidays. Nobody caught me. You know, So I got to reward myself. And I, underneath my stairs in my house, George, you saw it. Underneath my stairs in my house, there's like a little luggage closet room. You know, under the stairs, you can, you know, put luggage there. And I decide I'm going to go one last hurrah before I take my final sobriety breath. And I'm going to have a little hurrah under the stairs. And I go and I have my hurrah, but it doesn't work out. All right, I manage to overshoot the mark, and I don't get my last hurrah. I just pass out in my underwears. And come January 3rd, the guests are still in the house, and they'll say, "Where's Steve?" Now I come to under the stairs. I'm like, "Oh, this is not good." Still got the stuff there. I'm passed out in my underwear. People are like still drinking eggnog, you know, fa la 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 la, you know, like that. I'm thinking, how am I going to get out under the stairs? Family in the next room. And then there's the crack of the door opening. They open up the luggage closet. And there I am, sitting there, underwear, my stuff. And the reason I need to tell you that story is I need to always remember that. Like this week, they had a beautiful surprise party for me. My partner, my best friend here, and my wife, she threw a beautiful party for me, my 50th birthday. And people were going around saying beautiful stuff about me, how I helped change their life. And pastor of the church talked about what a great young man I am. And my son was there, and everybody was talking so beautiful about me. But, you know, 16 and a half years ago, I was underneath the steps. And if I ever get too full of myself and I start to believe that I'm that guy, I could always return back to the other guy, because I already had 6.5 years and I forgot that that other guy still lived. I just wanted to have a glass of wine, forgot that there's a monster inside of me that at any time when I add any type of substance to it, that monster comes out and says, "Feed me." So I want to always tell that story, because that story is still inside me. That person is still inside me. That devil is still inside me. That flesh is still with me. And I remember looking up at my parents and my wife, and they were crying. And they dropped me off with the detox, and nobody came in this time. Matter of fact, my wife and my mother, they didn't even come. My dad was already sober years. So he picked me up and he brought me to the detox, and he told me, "Don't call me for 6 months." And because my family's a big codependent mess like I am, they made sure that I couldn't call them, and they got on a cruise ship and left the country. And I'm in detox. And Jeff Weinstein, some of you guys might know that name from the Florida House, he comes into the detox, but it's really not the detox. Now I'm on the psychiatric floor because I tried to kill myself while I was waiting to get into detox. I'm like, "I'm going to kill myself." They said, "Well, that's another floor." Moving on up already. Already moving and shaking. Fifth floor. Jeff Weinstein comes in and he says, "How you doing? I'm from Liberty House. We're a halfway house in the area, and we'd like you to come and stay with us." And see, you know, the amazing thing about me is I just showered. I didn't shave because I was on suicide watch, but I just showered. I was already in my psychiatric gown that didn't really fit in the back. But you know, just if I shower, I'm already got some game back. You know, I'm already like, the guy comes in, you know, he's offering me like, to save my life, he says, "I'm going to invite you to come live at the Liberty House." And I get up in my gown and I say to him, "Well, I own a full house in Hollywood. I'm not going to any halfway house." You know, all psychiatric floored out. I'm still full of myself. And Jeff Weinstein tells me like this. He says, "You see this? This is from your wife. You know what this is? That's a restraining order. You don't have a house to go back to. You can't move back to your house. You're homeless." I said, "Tell me all about your program." Because I know I might be a big shot, but I don't know much about homeless. So I got myself involved with a halfway house. I moved into that halfway house. And that was the first time in my adult life I was in a halfway house. Now I'm 34. Last time I was in a halfway house, I was 24. It's a big difference in 24 to 34. Especially if you had 6.5 years of sobriety, you know the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You've been to meetings. You may not have worked it, but you've been in a lot of meetings. I've been in like 2,000 meetings. Now I'm in a halfway house with people that never even heard of Bill W. 10 minutes already? These meetings need to be... Can we try to get longer time on these meetings? And I get 30 days of sobriety. 30 hard days of sobriety. And I decide, I'm going to go get loaded. See, I had this tough sponsor by the name of Jerry Bear, and he told me that I needed to pray on my knees in the morning and ask God to keep me clean and sober, and I needed to ask him at night and say to him at night, thank you for the gift of sobriety. And I told you the story last week about being invited over to someone's house, and you go to that person's house, and you sit down at the table, and you eat food, and you don't say please, and then you get up from that table, and you walk to the door, and you don't say thank you, that you would never be invited back again. So why should I be in God's world one day without asking for the gift of sobriety and without saying thank you for the gift of sobriety at the end of the day? And so I'm praying on my knees in the morning. But while I'm praying on my knees in the morning, as I get up 45 degree angle from the knees, there's still bad Steve living in me. I'm only 30 days clean, so I either have bad Steve in me or I have good Steve living in me. As a matter of fact, I have that going on right now. The reason I go to 10 meetings a week and a Bible study and church service is because bad Steve still wants to come out. You see, the people that still believe that they're all good, like Annie, you still got some bad Annie in there. I'm not saying you could see it right up from the surface, but I'm sure she's still in there. I'm grateful that I still know that bad Steve still lives in there, because I spent a lot of time working on my key, asking God to help me with the defects of character that we'll go over in steps 6 and 7, and reminding myself that I have not arrived. I've left, but I haven't arrived. And so I get on my knees that morning and I'm praying to God to keep me clean and sober, and I get off my knees and I decide I'm going to go up and get whacked. And I look at my watch. It's 9 o'clock. Nobody's coming back to the halfway house till 4 o'clock. Mason and Big Eddie, they don't come back till 4 o'clock. I figured I could go get whacked. Because, you know, I don't know if you've ever had that junkie logic. You're sober a little while and you figure, well, you know, you think that you can have one drink because you've been sober for a little while and that's not going to have any effect. So I thought I could have a couple drinks, brush my teeth and shower and take a nap, and then nobody would know. And so I come up with a plan. I mean, I ask God to keep me clean and sober, but then I get up and I'm going to go get whacked. But I don't have any money. One thing about me is, and that's the truth, I really like to go out when I have money. I don't like to go on a run when I'm broke. I do not like to start off broke on a run. That is definite in the top 5 things. I like to have money before I go get whacked. So how am I going to get money? I'm 30 days clean. I got no job. I'm living in a halfway house that my wife is paying for me to be in there. And I decide I'm going to call my wife. Even though it is a restraining order, I'm going to call my wife. Because what else am I going to do? Let me call her up. Let me try it. So I said, sweetheart, I need $199 for a cell phone because my sponsor's in California. By the way, back then, that's what the cell phones cost. It's not like they have these plans now where you sign up for 72 years. There's a new type of cell phone stuff. And my wife says to me, hold on. And I figure she's checking the bank account. But she's not checking the bank account. My wife had joined the program of Al-Anon. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. 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 I heard Maria go, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah. She was ready for me. She put me on hold. She calls her sponsor. Her sponsor says, give the bum the money right now. Let's find out if he's full of it right now before we go through with the divorce papers. We'll do it right now if he's going to get high. Give him the money. And these two women set me up. They transfer $199 to a 30-day sober guy, and they set me up. And I know that I'm going to get whacked. But I know I also have to buy a cell phone, otherwise she's going to call the authorities. She's going to call Jeff Weinstein, and I'm going to get all found out. So I run to the cell phone store, and I say to the guy behind the counter, in my most abbreviated type of words, I say to the guy behind the counter, I need to have the cheapest cell phone you have, and I need to be out of here in 15 minutes. And the guy behind the counter says to me, Stevie B, it's so great to see you. We saw you yesterday at Victory. We saw you pick up under 30 days. It's so great to have you back. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And right there, my first step too came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, even though I didn't know I needed sanity or wanted sanity. He steps in anyway. See, it's not important that we know who He is, because He already knows who we are. It's just important that we have to follow directions. And 2 weeks from now, we'll talk a little bit more about that. God bless you guys.